I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. Today, we begin a week-long look back at President Obama's 8 years in the White House. Dr. Sherry Parks of the University of Maryland and Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist E.R. Shipp join us to talk about some of the president's most affecting speeches, from the address he delivered following the tragic mass shooting in Newtown, Connecticut, to his eulogy at the memorial for the Emmanuel Nine, to his farewell speech last week. How has the president shaped the conversation around major issues? We'll explore that, plus...
When they go low, we go high.
First Lady Michelle Obama, the nation's mom-in-chief. We'll talk about how Mrs. Obama redefined the role of First Lady even as she stared down racist attacks. That's all ahead on Midday, right after the news.
For those of us fortunate enough to have been part of this work and to see it up close, let me tell you, it can energize and inspire. And more often than not, your faith in America and in Americans will be confirmed. Mine sure has been.
Ever the optimist, President Barack Obama speaking in Chicago last Tuesday night. Welcome to Midday. Happy holiday, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad that you are spending part of your Martin Luther King Day holiday with us. This week here on the program, we're going to be talking about the legacy of Barack Obama from the perspectives of reporters and scholars from Maryland and beyond. On Thursday, I'll be joined by Michael Days from the Philadelphia Daily News to talk about his new book, Obama's Legacy, What He Accomplished as President. And on Wednesday, Dr. Michael Eric Dyson will be here to talk about his new book, a deeply personal and profound reflection called Tears We Cannot Stop, A Sermon to White America. Tomorrow, the Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Taylor Branch will be here with Michael Fletcher, a former national correspondent for The Washington Post and a senior writer for ESPN's The Undefeated. So today, I'm delighted to welcome two terrific observers of the body politic. Dr. Sherry Parks is an associate dean for research, interdisciplinary scholarship, and programming at the College of Arts and Humanities at the University of Maryland College Park, where she is also an associate professor in the Department of American Studies. She's the author of Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman, and a regular shower-upper here on Midday. Sherry, it's good
I
to see you.
I keep showing up. You keep put a mic in my face.
That's right. Was it Woody Allen said 85% of life is just showing up, and you've got that part now. It's good to see you, and happy
Thank you,
holiday.
I think.
And E.R. Shipp is a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for the Baltimore Sun and associate professor and journalist in residence in the School of Global Journalism and Communication at Morgan State University. Also no stranger to our microphone here at WYPR. It's good to see you. Happy holiday.
Thanks very much.
So, Shipp, let's start with you. Just your general thoughts on the matter of the legacy of President Obama.
Well, as everyone will probably say, if they're being very honest and fair, it's a very mixed one. And people such as myself are feeling a very much kind of a bittersweet sense of... I don't know. We're sad. And that's probably making it impossible to actually give a really good, thorough critique of the legacy. I was thinking about both the Obamas and how, on one level, you're just so proud that they were there and they had a scandal-free 8 years. They made us proud. Each of them has said they hope they made us proud. They made many of us proud. And because we're so caught up in all of that, I think it's very hard to do any real strenuous assessments of what they accomplished.
Yeah, and Sherry Parks, last time you were here, we were talking on our Culture Connections segment about optimism. And here's the president in this clip we just started with being this, you know, just... unfaltering optimist. He says he's optimistic about America and Americans. Yet there are so many people who think we've elected Donald J. Trump as the president of the United States. He gets inaugurated on Friday, and that's a cause for being, shall we say, less than optimistic about Americans.
And yet both he and his wife have said this line of that the line of history is not straight, so that you have to go through these times. But they still think and say that the end goal will be one of truth and honor among Americans. Mm-hmm. And so the optimism is not always happy. Sometimes it's resilient. And I think that's what they're showing.
Dr. Sherry Parks from the University of Maryland, E.R. Shipp from Morgan State University is here. If you would like to be part of our conversation about the legacy of President Obama and the First Lady Michelle Obama, our phone number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wypr.org. If you want to drop us a tweet, our handle is @MiddayTomHall. Martin Luther King, whose birthday we celebrate today, or whose holiday we celebrate today, said once that we are tied together in the garment of destiny. But I wonder if it's not the case, given the election, given the divisiveness of the campaign, despite the fact that we've had 8 years of a paradigm of calm, magnanimity, equanimity in the Obama administration and with the president. I wonder if the polarity between white and black, between people of color and the so-called majority culture, it seems even greater now than it was before he was elected.
It does seem that way. And to some extent, it may be that we're focused on it a little bit more. I'm not sure in many people's everyday lives that they necessarily feel any great animosity towards anyone else. But we are constantly told that that is the case. The vote was kind of showed that a lot of white people were feeling something out there. And some of them clearly are part of that alt-right segment of the GOP or followers of that philosophy. But I'm not sure that all of those voting for Trump truly were voting against a black person, a black agenda. I'm not convinced that we're any more divided. I think we're just more aware of it. And I think it was easier to focus our attention on some of those issues because we did have a black family in the White House.
So, Sherry Parks, what do you think? I mean, the Obama family, the model, the paradigm that they represented for families, white, black, and other, was that enough to push the conversation in a way? Because there's a lot of folks who think he didn't push the conversation on race nearly hard enough.
Well, it's interesting, and that's a very complex question you asked. He, in the last couple of weeks, has actually been talking about the very high expectations that he wrote in on. There was almost, particularly among African Americans, almost a messiah complex that somehow having the election of a black president meant that all of these things were going to happen much more than any one president could do. And yet, I mean, I think we see that the word that is used particularly for Michelle is grace. The way in which they have handled themselves has been exemplary. And the absence of that would have been catastrophic. So I think, did it take care of everything? No. Did it help that we saw them handle themselves that way when people were attacking them and their family and their dog? Yes. That helped.
Let's listen to a little bit more of the president's farewell speech in Chicago last Tuesday night.
For blacks and other minority groups, that means tying our own very real struggles for justice to the challenges that a lot of people in this country face. Not only the refugee or the immigrant or the rural poor or the transgender American, but also the middle-aged white guy who, from the outside, may seem like he's got advantages, but has seen his world upended by economic and cultural and technological change. We have to pay attention and listen. For white Americans, it means acknowledging that the effects of slavery and Jim Crow didn't suddenly vanish in the 60s. That when minority groups voice discontent, they're not just engaging in reverse racism or practicing political correctness, When they wage peaceful protests, they're not demanding special treatment, but the equal treatment that our founders promised.
So, Shipp, equal treatment. Now, here he is making an equivalency between the struggle for equality and justice among people of color and that middle-aged white guy in, you know, in Middletown, USA.
He couldn't have made that speech probably a few years ago. He wouldn't have made it because it would have been politically, you know, suicide. But I understand perfectly where he's going. In fact, that's kind of related to this this sense of hope he keeps telling us he wants us. He's optimistic that we can work our way through these things if only we can find a way to have that conversation. And I think he thinks that he's in a unique position to try to help us see the commonalities. We want equal rights, is what he's saying, for blacks. But he's not exactly using in that sentence that he's seeing an equivalency exactly between the conditions, the historic conditions of blacks and the conditions that some others are facing themselves. But I think the point is a good one, that we need to look beyond our own particular problems and reach to those who are also suffering. And maybe in finding some commonality, we can find a way towards progress. So a lot of focus after the election was on the angry white working class, as if there are no angry black working class people out there. So if the focus were on working class issues, whether you're black, white, Asian, or whatever, then maybe we can have a conversation that takes us further along than we are. So I kind of think that's what he was getting at, that we should be able to look beyond our own unique set of circumstances and find that there's something that we have in common with someone else.
And Sherry Parks, the president has certainly been a rising tide lifts all boats kind of guy. You know, thinking that if, as Shipp was saying, if the working class, be it white, black, or anything else, is lifted up, then everybody is helped. And so there's a disadvantage to concentrating on the plight of black Americans or white Americans as disparate, political identities.
Well, I agree with Shipp that he wouldn't have made those statements early on in his campaign, and so that all, you know, the rising tide lifts all boats is more the early statement. Now he's saying both, that we need to look at race and class. It's eerily similar to what Martin Luther King was saying toward the end of his life, where he was shifting away from a focus on race to all working class people, which in some ways may have made him more dangerous. Because as we've all noticed, race has been used to divide poor people, not just black, white, but Latinx people. I mean, that you're different somehow. And if all working class people in the United States recognize how much they have in common, that's a movement. And I think that is a very interesting statement.
I'm struck by the levels of applause that two of his lines got in that little clip. The first is when he said, we need to keep in mind the middle-aged white guy who from the outside may seem like he has all the advantages, but he's seen his world upended by all these various forces. And he got sort of polite applause. And that could have been from Democratic strategists who were saying, yes, you know. We should. So it's interesting that if he didn't say that earlier in his presidency, perhaps he should have. Maybe people are saying, you know, if you only had, then these folks who voted for you in 2008 and 2012 would not have defected from you and voted for Mr. Trump this time around. But then he got big applause when he mentioned that the effects of Jim Crow didn't end in the 1960s. So it is interesting that the way folks are responding to everything he said. But just also it's interesting to hear the grace and the erudition in his rhetoric and in his oratory. So we'll talk a little bit more about that when we come back from a break. E.R. Shipp from Morgan State University is with us, as well as Dr. Sherry Parks from the University of Maryland in College Park. Today's the first of 4 days this week in which We will assess the legacy of Barack Obama here on Midday. You are welcome to join us with your comments and questions. When we come back, we'll talk about the unparalleled impact of Michelle Obama. 410-662-8780 is our phone number here at Midday. Midday at WIPR.org is our email address. At Midday, Tom Hall is our Twitter handle. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Like a fool, I went and stayed too long.
Signed, sealed, delivered, indeed. First Lady Michelle Obama singing one of her favorite Stevie Wonder tunes with Late Late Show host James Corden last summer. This particular edition of Carpool Karaoke has been viewed more than 9 million times. Whether she was doing push-ups with Ellen DeGeneres or mom dancing with Jimmy Fallon, Michelle Obama established herself as an incredibly personable and very different kind of First Lady. Just as her husband's White House tenure was historic, so was hers and her family's. We're talking about the Obama legacy all this week here on Midday. We welcome your comments and reflections about the president and the First Lady. 410-662-8780, our Twitter handle at Midday Tom Hall, our email address midday@wipr.org. This afternoon, I'm joined in Studio A by E.R. Shipp, the journalist in residence and professor at Morgan State University. In 1996, she won a Pulitzer Prize for her columns in the New York Daily News that focused on race, welfare, and social issues. She now writes a biweekly column for the Baltimore Sun. Dr. Sherry Parks is here with us as well. She's an associate dean at the College of Arts and Humanities at the University of Maryland College Park and an associate professor in the Department of American Studies. Sherry is our guest each month here on Midday for Culture Connections, and she's the author of Fierce Angels, Living with the Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. So, Sherry, speaking of strong black women, if ever there were one, it's Michelle Obama. She
yes.
really has changed our notion in so many ways, certainly of what a first lady could be, but perhaps even what strong black women can be.
It depends on who our is in that statement.
Yeah. But I'm talking about everybody. I mean, I'm talking about men, women, white people, black people. I mean, I think a lot of folks just have never thought of it before.
Because what she has done, I mean, for as a black woman, is pulled out a very familiar type of behavior and grace and put it on the public stage. So we recognize that woman who was raised to be cordial to everybody no matter what. I grew up in North Carolina, and this will say how old I am. The phrase was, you could sit next to Jesse Helms and be polite. And so she exemplifies that, and it was about survival, really. And so, but she carries that, and she carries it so well. At the same time, she's a truth teller. So that she says what she means, and she was called a truth teller during the campaign, that she would be the one that would kind of come out and say, well, what Barack really meant was this. So I think she really has shown America and the world the way a grown black woman can carry herself through the world.
And Shipp, she does it with this sort of incredible subtle touch. She's not, I mean, she's very strong, obviously, but she's not a hammerer. She's precise, she's acute, and she is beloved. I mean, her approval ratings now among voters, sky high. She was Secretary Clinton's greatest surrogate on the campaign trail. I mean, the credibility and the affection that America holds her in is really quite something.
But she had to grow into that. It didn't start out that way. Life was no crystal stair at the beginning of this 8 years. A number of people criticized her for being the angry black woman, which is something that you are familiar with, because she was so different from what they were accustomed to. She was able to do, I mean, she's not the first first lady who had had a professional career. Of course, Hillary Clinton had done that, but she could combine the best of that with also being the mom in chief. And she took on causes that allowed her to shine in her own right and establish that kind of credibility, whether it was working with military families or her emphasis on childhood obesity and just having that garden there at the White House to encourage healthy eating. But she was also just comfortable in being herself. She had to get to that point, as she has said in some of these exit interviews with Oprah and even Jimmy Fallon and others. She had to get to a point where she decided she had to be herself, to be a mature, grown woman who knew what she had been before she got to the White House, and to develop that into these, while focusing on the issues she wanted to focus on.
Here's another little clip, speaking of Jimmy Fallon, where she was doing the thank you notes with Jimmy Fallon. I don't know exactly when this was. I guess this was last week.
Thank you, Barack, for proving you're not a lame duck, but my very own silver fox.
That's so beautiful. I mean, and that's the part that I started weeping hysterically at the farewell speech, is when the president acknowledged her and their daughter, the one who didn't have an exam the next day, yeah. who was there. You mentioned in your book, Sherry, that the New York Times, of all places, Maureen Dowd, accused her early on of emasculating her husband because she was so strong. It's amazing to think that that actually happened.
Well, she had said something that many spouses would say, but she said it in public, that when he woke up in the morning, he was kind of snory and stinky. And people were saying, well, how could you talk about the president that way? And she was just telling the truth. She was being real and saying, well, you know, this guy who's very polished, and she was, he's not always like that. And I think she humanized him by doing that. And yeah, she got a lot of people attacked her, particularly during the campaign before she was first lady.
Sure. And as Shipp mentions, I mean, she was a reluctant signer on to this little project. But boy, she grew into it with incredible grace. Is there a particular key to her success, as it were? I mean, is there a particular thing that has led her to be so beloved?
Well, you mentioned Hillary Clinton, who, of course, was famous as first lady for saying that she didn't bake cookies. And so she really had the separation between the professional Hillary Clinton and the mom. And I mean, I'm going to go back to the lives of Black women, where there's never been any division between having to go to work every day and taking care of your children. So Black women never had to fight to work because they had to work. And most of the Black middle class is middle class because of that second income. And she carried that wholeness, that fluidity into the White House. So she was, you know, a brilliant lawyer. And I mean, I winced a little when she said, I'm going to be mom in chief. But then I saw how she was weaving that together. And that was the perfect defense against the angry Black woman label that was pasted onto her during the campaign.
Julia in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with E.R. Shipp and Sherry Parks. Glad you could call.
Yes, finally, after a couple of days, I get through. But on a very good subject, I compare Michelle Obama with Jackie Kennedy, as far as grace under the public eye.
Well, thank you.
And, you know, I just think that she's been great.
Well, thanks for your call, Julia. Jackie Kennedy, perhaps another somewhat reluctant first lady, at least at the start, obviously knew she was married to an ambitious man in President Kennedy. But do you think there are legitimate analogies there, Shipp?
Well, I suppose in terms of style, Michelle Obama has become something of a trendsetter, style icon, and she's actually gone into that, too. She looks quite different now than she did when she first entered the White House. I think she's become a little bit more comfortable moving beyond the J. Crew ensembles that she sported at the beginning to now some of the designer pieces. But she also perhaps can be compared to Jacqueline Kennedy in trying to make the White House somewhat of a home. Particularly, they both had young children, so that was important for both of them. But I think she went beyond Jackie Kennedy, who was still more upper crust And so the people she would have invited to the White House were a different class than Michelle Obama did. Michelle opened the doors to everybody. And I think that's why a lot of people really grew to love her even more. So she would have the Girl Scouts camping out on the lawn for a nighttime party, and just regular folks could feel like they could come to events there. She would let kids sit at the dining table and use the actual china that came with the White House. That was kind of bold of her. But and then with the arts, she and the president welcomed everybody from hip hop to the classics. So that the White House became the people's house under her, even more than under a Jackie Kennedy.
What do you think, Sherry? Some analogies there? Are there analogies to any other first ladies?
Well, I think the analogy to Jackie Kennedy is interesting because, as you pointed out, Jackie came from extreme wealth. And for Michelle Obama to arrive at a similar state, having come from the South Side of Chicago, is a very interesting statement that you can carry yourself in a certain way. And it is the American story of her hardworking parents, and then she goes to college and ends up in the White House. I think there's a bit of Eleanor Roosevelt to her in terms of her causes and her ability to speak to a public in the ways her husband cannot. She became a target like Eleanor Roosevelt in the ways that Barack cannot, because she's a dark-skinned black woman. And during the campaign, people were hitting her when they couldn't hit him, or not in the same way. And by hitting her, they really were hitting hard at someone who looked like a black woman.
Is it incumbent upon any first family? I mean, will it be incumbent upon the Trumps? Was it incumbent upon the Clintons or the Bushes to model a great marriage? I mean, when the marriage of Bill and Hillary Clinton ran into a major speed bump, we all heard about it, and people berated Mr. Clinton for not being the kind of husband he should have been.
And on white radio, they said she should leave him. Black radio was different. They said stand by him. But there was this, you should leave, and she really couldn't while he was still in the White House and in trouble. That's very interesting, because it moves the presidency away from being the statesman to being this iconic American family. And it was the Kennedys who first did that, because they were the first real TV presidency. And certainly it's happened with the Obamas, where there has been, well, we just heard it when the audience said, "Oh," when she said, "You know, you're my silver fox." And so there is a kind of stand-up marriage, and the way there are lots and lots of pictures of them looking into each other's eyes, and you say, these people really like each other. They really love each other. And certainly, I mean, there was a piece that I'm quoted in where black women are saying, "I'm waiting for my Barack," or "I know I'm not going to get my Barack," but Barack becomes the standard for a good husband who still finds you attractive, and yet does all the good stand-up things of providing. It's kind of, you know, the 50s iconic man brought into the 21st century.
Also probably necessary, I think, to allay a lot of the fears that people had of having a black family in the White House. Mm-hmm. They had to be more perfect in everything. So they had to have the perfect marriage, and it appears that they do have a strong marriage and friendship and all of that. But they had to, the White House had to be run perfectly well. So they lived up to expectations, or I guess they exceeded expectations, but they allayed a lot of fears. I know, especially as a black person, your fear was always that they were going to stumble somehow in a way that reflected badly on the entire race. So throughout the 8 years, you're sort of on edge a little bit about what's going on with him.
And that's also a defensive stance. It wasn't so much for me that I thought that they would stumble, but that somebody would be able to label them with something. They would take some small thing, like when she said, "I've never been more proud of my country," and that became
that was during the campaign.
A huge firestorm of she hates
totally
the country.
Totally taken out of context.
Right. And I think also had to play this defensive game of never giving anybody an excuse. Mm-hmm. Did your grandmother tell you that? Never give them an excuse to label you that mm-hmm. way. And I think that was an important thing. And I agree, because the specter of the black man, particularly at the beginning of the presidency, was a dangerous person. You know, the black man is dangerous. He's a sexual predator. He's a criminal. And this is probably the most prominent image, of a very different man.
Yeah. I mean, just even, we would always hear the stories about how the president would have dinner with the family, the two girls, the mother-in-law, and his wife, every night at 6:30 on the days that he was in town. And then he would go to the study and his private office and work into the wee hours of the evening. But he paused for dinner. Just the family had dinner. And I think that was something sort of universally applauded and admired, and so many families look around and say, gosh, we never see each other.
Yeah, we can't do it.
The President of the United States can pull it off, but we can't somehow pull it off.
He's got some butlers and cooks
and people
helping.
He's got some folks helping.
Yeah, but the idea that it was such an important thing for him throughout the presidency was important for all of us to model.
Gary from Baltimore, welcome to Midday with E.R. Shipp and Sherry Parks.
Thank you for having me, hello to the doctors. And what I wanted to kind of bring it back out, I mean, it kind of went toward the way to the First Lady as far as her grace. But I wanted to kind of shine the light on what it took for them for the first, basically two phases. They had two phases, the first 4 years and then the second 4 years. And how will that be evaluated from the standpoint of the legacy that it probably was a drastic change, or maybe a gradual? Can anybody speak to the change they may have saw between the first 4 years, when it had to be a lot more political, and then this last 4 years?
Because obviously, you know, he was hoping to run for re-election, which he did, and he won handily the second time around. Sherry Parks, what do you think? Is there a marked contrast between first term, second term?
Well, he also has to worry about congressional elections, and he was always aware of that. I think we've seen the largest change most recently as he's on his way out, and I think I'm excited to see what he will do after he's not president anymore. But I think you're right that there was a progression of that, and now he's freer to speak in ways that he was not.
Well, things like the pardoning of so many nonviolent drug offenders commutations of their sentences, mm-hmm. because he's concentrated on criminal justice. He's concentrated on these egregious incarceration rates
and the
disparities. He can do that kind of stuff now in the last few months of his presidency that even in the first few months of his second term would have been more difficult to do.
And he's brought up Guantanamo Bay as one of his regrets, that he hasn't been able to empty Guantanamo Bay. And I don't remember hearing him say that word for years.
Guantanamo Bay.
Yes.
Yeah. No, he counts that among one of the things that I guess he's...
But he's saying it now.
Yeah.
And I don't think he talked about it for years.
Yeah. I think that's right. And he's also speaking about race in ways that he did not necessarily do before. I saw something that indicated that there was a large gap from 2009 until about, when was Trayvon Martin, 2013. There was a large gap where you didn't really hear much about race until he did start addressing it with the Trayvon Martin case. And then he's been a little bit stronger even on it in the last year or so.
And he said it in a particularly personal way. Trayvon could have been my son.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Sherry Parks from the University of Maryland and E.R. Shipp, the journalist in residence at Morgan State University, will be back with more thoughts on the legacy of the Obamas as they prepare to leave the White House Friday morning. You are welcome to join our conversation, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @midday. Tom Hall. We'll be talking about the Obama years all week here on Midday. Tomorrow, my guest will be Michael Fletcher, a senior writer at The Undefeated, the multifaceted web platform of ESPN. He's a former national correspondent for The Washington Post, covered the Bush administration. We'll be joined by the Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Taylor Branch, who wrote a groundbreaking book about the presidency of Bill Clinton. And on Wednesday, my guest will be Dr. Michael Eric Dyson, the author of a powerful new book called Tears We Cannot Stop, A Sermon to White America. And on Thursday, we'll speak with Michael Days, an editor at the Philadelphia Daily News, about his new book, which takes stock of the Obama presidency. And on Friday, NPR will bring you live coverage of the inauguration of Donald Trump as the 45th president of the United States. So before we take a break, on Mondays here on Midday, we read the names of the people who lost their lives to violence in the city of Baltimore during the previous week. We stand in witness to their lives, and we remember their families and friends in their hour of grief. So far this month, 13 people have already been victims of homicide in our city. These are the people who were killed in Baltimore last week. Jeffrey Douglas, age 47. Chris Pennington, age 32. Cody Boyd, age 26. Sean Bay, age 27. Dominique Thaniel, age 37. Dominique Hall, age 24. And Deshaun McKelveen. He was 17 years old. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me.
I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us for this special Martin Luther King Day edition of Midday, my guests are Dr. Sherry Parks from the University of Maryland and E.R. Shipp, Baltimore Sun columnist and journalist in residence at Morgan State University. We're talking about the legacy of President Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama, the first part of our four-part consideration of the historic presidency of America's first African-American president. Our number here on Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Shipp, that was an amazing moment, full of amazing grace, both literally and metaphorically. Is there a particular key to the power of the president's oratory? I mean, people have made note. I think the New York Times even compared him to Lincoln as an orator. Just his power of communication is really quite singular in a lot of ways.
I think that's right. He's also an amazing writer. So he writes a lot of his own speeches, and you can also see his writing in his books. But he it goes beyond the skill of a lawyer. There are a lot of lawyers out there who are not nearly as gifted as he is in communicating. But I think he has a good sense of the place and a sense of what his audience needs to hear, and he tries to strike that balance there. In that clip you just played, it wasn't just that he, after giving a brilliant message there at the church, it wasn't just that he chose to sing Amazing Grace, but it was the version of the song even that he chose. He lifted an old hymn in the style that really touches the souls of people who grew up in the South, especially. That would be the way my grandparents sang Amazing Grace. So he knew, I guess, words alone were not enough to convey what he was trying to say there. And just picking that particular spiritual at that time did.
You know, Ta-Nehisi Coates in the Atlantic Magazine said that for 8 years he walked on ice and he never fell.
That's true. He has a very good ability to shift, and this is related to what you said, where he can speak with the erudition of Lincoln and then fluidly slip into Amazing Grace with in the way that you do in what's called the Black Church, where you go from oratory and you just start singing. Black pastors do that every Sunday. And when you were talking about the way your grandfather, he used what's called a long note, where you hold on this note and you slide in to it. And I think that his ability to do that is when you really get the audience with you, his ability to read an audience, I agree with you, and feel with you, where sometimes he is in so much pain that you can feel it. And that's not the traditional presidential stance. Bill Clinton said, I feel your pain. And I think with Obama, we see that he hurts along with the audience.
We saw that at Newtown.
Right, where he just cried. Right,
Yeah. 410-662-8780 is our number here on Midday. I'm Tom Hall in the studio with E.R. Shipp from Morgan State University and Sherry Parks from the University of Maryland College Park. Our email address, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. We'll go back to the phones. Janet in Baltimore, you've been patient. Thanks so much for your call. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me, and thanks for taking my call, and thanks for doing this show. I just want to make a couple of other comments about Barack Obama and why I think he will eventually go down as one of the greatest presidents we've ever had, if not the greatest. Our president had so much opposition from the very beginning. He went in there, and like Michelle said, you know, when they go low, we go high, and he remained there. And I think he was constantly in just comments he made, and the singing that you just had on was always speaking kind of under the table. I don't want to say, I can't think of another word, to African Americans, because he had to lead all people. So he had that to think about. He had all the opposition, and he still had a lot of racism to face as well. So I am so proud of this president and so happy that you're doing this. And I hope all Americans, and I'm going to say, yes, white Americans, listen to this and understand what we have now and what we are about to get. And I appreciate you taking my call. I'll listen on the air for your comment.
Well, thank you for your call, Janet. Much appreciated. Shipp, there are those who point to the president's sort of standoffish stance with, for example, groups like the Congressional Black Caucus. Maxine Waters from California at one point had to sort of call him out and say, look, we haven't had a meeting with you in 16 months, 18 months or something. We got to get together. So there are folks who are saying, you know, he could have built stronger alliances within Congress, and his legislative agenda perhaps might have, had some different outcomes had he been better at that. I don't know. What do you think?
I've heard that, but you've got to remember that at the same time he was just preparing to come into the office, the senior leadership of the Republican Party, congressional leadership, was meeting to take a vow to block him at every step. So he really had no real chance to win over a large segment of the Congress. I'm not sure what the relationship ultimately ended up being with the Congressional Black Caucus, but when you look at it, they were not the most effective, so maybe they just didn't factor into what he thought he needed to expend his energies on. But we know that he didn't like schmoozing and that kind of thing with anybody. He thought that was kind of a waste of his time to be doing that. One other thing in that regard, he not only faced opposition from that GOP, there were a number of black folks who very publicly opposed him because they thought he really should be pursuing a black agenda when he was trying to pursue something that would help everybody.
Sherry Parks, Michael Eric Dyson, in a book that he wrote about the Obama presidency, and he'll be our guest here on Midday on Wednesday to talk about his newest book, which he calls A Sermon to White People. But he wrote a book called The Black Presidency, Barack Obama and the Politics of Race in America. And here on this Martin Luther King Day, Dyson suggests that Dr. King has become the language of race itself. That's the phrase he uses, that, you know, race cannot be discussed at all without a mention and allusion to Dr. King. Where will Barack Obama fit into the language of race moving forward now that we've had 8 years of this historic presidency?
Well, I mean, it won't be the first time I've disagreed with Dyson, but I think that saying that MLK is the language of race is an overstatement. That certainly it's kind of almost a stock go-to, but they're not really talking about the man that you'll talk about with Taylor Branch. They're talking about this McDonaldized piece of thing that they're talking about. But I want to go back to what Janet was saying, is that I think often the Obamas were doing a kind of subtle demonstration of blackness that wasn't in your face and stereotypical. And I think that is something that speaks to many black people who are moving into new spaces, that you carry your blackness with you. You're not necessarily, you know, walking in and saying, I'm Sherry Parks, I'm black, but your very presence speaks to that. And I think that kind of newness of not becoming like a white person, but carrying your blackness into these previously all white spaces is part of his legacy, because, of course, he pushed it where many of us thought we would never see a black person in the White House. We were calling the Clintons the first black president because he was about as close as we thought he would get. And I think that will be an important part of the legacy, is that how are you black in these new spaces?
Let's get back to the phones. Bridget in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Sherry Parks and E.R. Shipp.
Thank you very much. I just want to say that I think Barack Obama is one of the most humane, human, intellectual presidents we've ever had, with great grace and dignity, and he faced constant abuse from the Republican Party, and I have no doubt that much of it was because he was black, and I think he is such an example to all of us of all races of how to live as a true and full human being. Thank you.
Thanks for your call, Bridget. Shipp, we just got about 30 seconds left here. Let's talk quickly about this notion of legitimacy, because President Obama was subjected to claims of illegitimacy by none other than the person who's now going to assume the office of president on Friday. And, of course, there was this exchange between him and Congressman Lewis about this very notion.
Well, what we're already seeing is that the president-elect is very thin-skinned. And I think he's very insecure himself about how legitimate he is as president. As long as there's this pall hanging over him with the involvement of the Russians in hacking the emails of the Democratic Party and all of that, and maybe even doing something else to assist him, his election. So he flipped out when Congressman Lewis said that he doesn't consider him legitimately the president. And I think in this back and forth, we're probably beginning to see much more of the true Donald Trump. And I hope that those who had not been aware of it before are watching and listening.
E.R. Shipp is a journalist in residence and professor at Morgan State University. Dr. Sherry Parks is an associate dean of the College of Arts and Humanities at the University of Maryland College Park and an associate professor in the Department of American Studies. Her terrific book is called Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. Tomorrow we'll continue our assessment of the legacy of President Barack Obama with Pulitzer Prize winning historian Taylor Branch and Michael Fletcher from ESPN's The Undefeated. I'd like to thank the Diz for supplying lunch today for our guests. The Diz is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington and features signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo lump crab cakes. The Diz is open for lunch and dinner with breakfast served weekends on the web at DizBaltimore.com. That'll do it for us today. Here and Now is up next at the top of the hour. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tom Hall. Have a great day.